and non-benders alike, welcome to Braving the Elements, Nickelodeon's podcast about all things Avatarverse. Again, I sounded like I was warning people. I don't know where that has come from, but suddenly now I'm like, you better be ready for the Avatarverse podcast. I'm Janet Varney.
And I'm Dante Bosco, and they better be ready because we have some special guests in the house today, Varney.
But before we get too deep into this episode, I am butting in here on my own. Dante and I are separately traveling to New York Comic Con, but we wanted to quickly get this piece of information in as a break bite for this episode because it comes right off the heels of the waterbending scroll. So here we go. A new break bite. And in this case, it was generated by you, specifically at Geek Potatoes on Twitter, who said, hey, Avatar people, can someone explain why this monkey in season 1, episode 9 got so much attention and then disappeared? I feel like this is something y'all can answer on your podcast. I appreciate the use of y'all, Geek Potatoes. And I want to let you know, I took that very seriously. I went ahead and went straight to the top. And this is what I came up with. To break. Hi, dads. I'm wondering if I could ask about the little monkey figurine in the waterbending scroll that mesmerizes Katara, is presumably purchased by Iroh, and shows up from time to time in the series. Yours ever truly, and this is what I heard back. From Brian. Hi, Janet. Maybe Mike has more info since I don't think I was in the writer's room when they came up with this. I just recall working on the design with Aldina Diaz, our prop designer. I think it was mostly her drawing, and I might have done a few tweaks to it. I don't think it was any big Easter egg or reference, just a bit of random silliness. But again, Mike might know more. And this is what Mike had to say. I know nothing. I'm thinking it was probably a moment of John O'Brien random humor since it was his episode. But sorry, no great backstory to it, which probably doesn't help. And you know what I said, friends? I said it does help, because it's an answer. It's an official break answer, and that's what we're aiming to do here. Even if it's something small, and it doesn't turn out that there's a huge backstory to it, we're aiming to solve some of those tiny mysteries. In fact, I would say the tiny mysteries may be my favorites. Now let's get back to our music episode. Let me say this. We love the fans. We love the fans. We love our peers. We love the fans who are peers. Half of the fans in the Avatarverse seem to be amazing artists in their own right. And the reason I'm saying this is they love the details. They love paying attention to all of the things, all of the components that make this world so amazing. And I feel like we had released one episode and already people were writing us and saying, are you gonna have Jeremy on? And we're like, right. whoa, hey, we released one episode. Yes, we are. We got a whole plan. But that's saying a lot about not just the fans, but of course, the phenomenal music composition of this show. So we are so excited to welcome, of course, our friend, the composer extraordinaire, Jeremy Zuckerman. We are also very, very excited to have an Avatar The Last Airbender fan, but also someone worth freaking out about because he has created the beloved podcast Song Exploder, which of course is now also a television series on Netflix. His band, the 1AM Radio, is fantastic. Please, please welcome Hrishikesh Hirway.
Most notably, I think, for your listeners especially, and my heart, there was a Song Exploder episode with Jeremy about the music from Korra.
Yeah.
Oh, from the last episode of Korra.
Yeah. I listened to that over the weekend when I was on a walk, and I was walking through a neighborhood with tears streaming down my face, feeling like I was alarming many people, but...
It's kind of amazing that just hearing Jeremy talk about that scene and hearing the music without the context of the episode, I mean, I think that was the experience for a lot of people that even divorced from the actual visuals and the plot in that moment, hearing all of that, the power of Jeremy's music.
I want to be clear. I was not crying at what Jeremy was saying. I was crying listening to the music, which I hasten to add was a part of the Song Exploder podcast episode. And I reached out to you, Rishi, super quick because when I talked to Jeremy about doing the episode, I said, what if we had Rishi join us to talk about the music of Avatar?
Absolutely.
You both
bring
are
him
very
in.
Sweet. Not you, Dante.
Well,
I thank you for nothing.
I'm here. I'm actually so excited. This is the thing, like going through the show with Varney now, it's like, not that I'm going to be an expert by the end of this, but we're just not some cute voices in the show. We also know some little tidbits about themes and artistry and the music now. I think it's fascinating.
Well, I was just wondering, Jeremy, do you feel like it is part of your job as a composer to be deeply immersed in the world and understand all of the world building, all of the mythology, all of the backstories of all the characters in order to do what
question,
you do?
Damn it.
Wow, that is a profound question. Short answer, I'm inclined to say no, because a lot of that stuff reveals itself over the course of the project, right? And there's things that I don't know and I don't understand about the characters. But the beauty is, as I learn more and I understand more, as I experience the show, their themes deepen and they change and there's more variations. You know, like Zuko, for instance, is a good example. You know, he starts the show with a sort of very surface level kind of bad guy theme. And by the end, he has all, you know, these really sort of intimate, more emotional themes and themes that speak to the subtext and themes that speak to his development as a character and as a person, and themes that sort of call back, you know, but comment on who he was and who he is now and that kind of thing. So the beautiful thing about, you know, composing for TV versus film even, is that you have this relationship with the music that lasts sometimes for many years, and it changes just like as if you know a person for many years, right? And you sort of experience things together and you grow together. And that's what happens with these themes. And it's just a really sort of singular experience that you don't really get from working in any other medium.
Jeremy, of course, you are here representing the music portion of the sort of sound landscape of Avatar. But of course, Benjamin Wynn, who designed sound for The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra, you know, lots of stories about the two of you working side by side and being very much that collaborative effort and the places where all of those things overlap. Do you prefer that kind of collaboration?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've had like a sort of strange relationship with the collaboration, because there's times when I'm like, I need to establish a balance with collaboration. Like if I'm collaborating too much, I start to feel sort of like, I want to be alone and like focus on my own ideas and sort of go off in my own selfish directions, you know what I mean? And not really have to like justify or validate or explain an idea before it's ready, that kind of thing. Because when I'm collaborating, I tend to be very conscious of the other person's sort of perception of what I'm doing. So there might be an idea that I want to explore that I'm not sure will be successful. And it might take a lot of time before it actually becomes anything. But I won't pursue it because I'm like, they're going to see this and be like, this is not good. This guy is not very good at what he does. And it's like
totally
a whole thing.
I get that.
We've all been those people on the sets. Like, I don't know what I'm doing yet, but I'm going to improv a few things here.
It might lead somewhere. Let's just go down this rabbit hole, you know? It's a little scary doing that with people watching, you know?
Totally. So, absolutely.
But
I feel
the
like
others,
I'm going to get fired the first few days of anything
totally.
I shoot. I'm like, they're going to fire me, like, by noon, by lunchtime, I'm out of here, I think.
Totally. Well, yeah, that whole imposter syndrome like really flares up when someone else is in the room, you know? I've actually brought in an intern. Just having an intern behind me who's like a fan of the show and like, you know, he wanted to work for me because he grew up watching Avatar and everything. I'm like, oh man, he's going to see right through me. You know what I mean? And I feel very inhibited because I've gotten very used to working alone.
I love that you're sharing that. It's so relatable, though. It's like, now that there's someone here, it's completely changed my relationship to the thing that I'm trying to create. I'm not trying to be performative right now, but suddenly, by virtue of this other person, I'm performing, which totally can take you out.
This is literally why I'm doing this podcast, because fans ask me questions about the show that I did do. I did. That is my voice. And then there will be a blank look on my face like I have no clue
I hear
what you're talking about. It's like, you're part of this great, great thing, amazing, like timeless, amazing, perfect project. And I'm like, what did I do? What happened?
Yeah.
What did we do?
It's the synergy of all of us, you know? I mean, it was this amazing thing, and it happened in an amazing time. And
right, but it can also bring that like intimidating imposter feeling that you were talking about, right?
Yeah, but the other side is I've also done stuff where, you know, I've had people sort of fill in the gaps and recognize when something's valuable before I do and, you know, keep me in good spirits, and there's a feedback loop, so I'm never sort of feeling like I'm searching in the dark and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's got to be a balanced thing for me, you know. But for Ben and I, we started way back before we weren't even hired by Nickelodeon yet. And we were working on like pencil tests and other things. And Brian was in the another room, like creating the characters and showing us stuff. And it was so beautiful. And we'd be working, and it was very like collaborative in the beginning. And then once we got the gig, like the idea was we were going to do sound design and music as one thing.
Yeah.
We had this idea that sound design and music don't need to be separate. Like it could be thought of as the same thing, and the music would be very abstract and the sound design would be more abstract. But as the show, so like very quickly we realized like that wasn't appropriate for this show. You know, it was like a cool idea. Everyone loved the idea, but it wasn't working for what we were doing. So after the pilot, I took over the duties of music, and Ben took over the duties of sound design. And we actually thought at some point we might switch. Like we thought, okay, maybe after the first season we'll switch. Hmm. And then by then we were like so down those roads. We were like, no way. You know, we tried switching one day and we're like, how do you do this? I was trying to do sound design. I was like, what is going on? And Ben was trying to do music, and we were just like, no, dude. Like,
Stay in your lane.
Yes, let's stay in our lane. That's cool. Yeah.
But that's so funny, because I mean, that's another thing. And I would refer again, there's some great history out there already in the podcast world. Not that I'm discouraging anyone from completing listening to this episode, but my point being, as auxiliary kind of material, our dear, dear friend Hector Navarro did a wonderful interview with you and Brian Konietzko many years ago. But you really delve into that process. And I've heard you say, I think elsewhere, that, you know, you did kind of you benefited from that I don't know what I'm doing blind cockiness of like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't know what you were getting yourself into.
Yeah,
until
like how new were totally. You at just doing the film side of music when you started doing guitar?
I had done a couple years of doing commercials, okay. Which is pretty different, you know, because like a long commercial is 60 seconds, maybe 90. Like that's an epic, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So going from that, like, what I gained doing commercials was sort of a range, like an ability to have a range creatively, technically. But as far as developing ideas over a long period of time, like that was a new thing for me. And it was very hard in the beginning. It was really stressful. Like it took me way too long, you know. And it's amazing that Brian and Mike fought for us and like kept us on the gig, because I'm sure there are other people that were way more skilled and no doubt, like people who had experience. But I think that was part of the appeal too. You know, I remember Brian specifically saying he didn't want a seasoned TV composer. He wanted someone coming in that was sort of like figuring it out as they were going along and approaching it from a totally different place. And you can hear that in the earlier season, I think. I think in some ways it becomes more traditional, like as the show progresses, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, right now we're barely halfway through the first book. So what you're referring to is very much like what we're kind of steeped in right now, you know? I wanted to ask you, because you've composed for film as well. What is that first experience like when someone approaches you and you know that they're potentially putting this very personal work, because how could it not be, in your hands? You know, Brian and Mike said, like, we want it to sound ancient but fictional. Rishi, when you are working on something, does someone come at you and say, like, okay, number one thing you should know, I love the xylophone. Now, the movie is da-da-da. Like, how much do you want to get from someone at the beginning versus how much are you bringing to it? You know what I mean?
Well, I haven't done a lot of composing, and I think it's for the reason what Jeremy mentioned about the experience that he gained in doing commercials, of being able to sort of approach many different kinds of scenes, many different kinds of problems with he has a really great sort of Swiss Army knife. I don't have that. I kind of had been in a band for a really long time and spent so long trying to develop a kind of like a pretty narrow aesthetic that usually the only times when I do stuff is when someone's like, I know the music that you make. And
okay.
I know that you also can do, you know, scoring. Couldn't we apply that to this? I have this project that feels like it would match up with that, and then I feel comfortable. If
they want the Rishi treatment, if they're coming to you, it's because they want specifically what they know that you're brilliant at.
I mean, only in the cases that's worked out. There have been times when it hasn't been like that, where they're like, hey, we need a composer, will you do it? And I would just say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they would say, okay, it needs to sound like this. And I was like, I don't know how to do that. And then it hasn't worked out.
But the beautiful thing about that is you get to make the music that you want to make for money.
Great point.
You know, which is actually pretty rare. I think, you know, a lot of times when you have a lot of range, there might be like the music you would make in your own time and then the music you get paid for. And sometimes they're like on opposite ends of the spectrum.
Right.
I've definitely been there, you know, and it doesn't mean it's been like a miserable experience or something. It's actually really interesting to make music like that you would never make. But there's times where I'm like, man, can I just make some music that like I would actually make if I, you know, were in my house? Like, and some of Avatar music is like that. And some of it is on the other side of the spectrum where it's like, I'm making this because it's right for the project, but it wouldn't be something I would do, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there's, I don't know if I want to say pros and cons, but it is, I've always thought it's like a really wonderful thing for a composer to get hired to do the music that they do in their own time. And I think that's really special, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, as young artists, young kids, did you guys ever listen to like John Williams or like Danny Elfman? Like, were you listening to any Trent Reznor? Oh, man, he's doing some crazy stuff for these films and television things. Did that ever occur to you? I mean, for like the fans listening that are like, how do you get into composing? How does that even start in your mind as a young, you know, person?
For me, Danny Elfman was the guy.
Yeah.
The theme for the first Batman movie with Michael Keaton, you know, which is going back a ways. But classic. I was like, this is amazing. This music sounds like what Batman should be. And then, you know, and then his music, his score to Edward Scissorhands is a huge, huge influence on me. I think that kind of
score.
Yeah. Speaking of loving xylophones, all of that kind of like delicate, icy kind of music. I really wanted to make that. Even I think before I was thinking about scoring, just in terms of the aesthetics of the music that I wanted to make, I was like, I wanted to feel something like this.
Yeah.
Did
you know it was Danny Elfman? Or did you think Danny Elfman was like Oingo Boingo? You're like,
No. I didn't realize I didn't put together that Danny Elfman was part of Oingo Boingo until like a few years ago.
I mean, that's not true. But like, many Trent Reznor and like Mark Mothersbaugh, like there's so much.
And Trent Reznor, you're like, that's Nine Inch Nails. Yeah.
There's such a legacy of people leaving like post-punk bands and then becoming these super versatile composers. For me, it was Never Cry Wolf, which is this Disney movie, but it's this beautiful movie that's shot in the Arctic. And that's, I'm a kid from Tucson, and I would listen to the soundtrack. I found a CD copy of the soundtrack by Mark Isham, and I would listen to it because it was cold, and I was hot. And I, to this day, when I listen to really great composed film soundtracks that take place in the cold, there's a continuity to it. You hear a lot of like sort of high open penny whistle sort of sounds and this sort of swell of strings, but it's, you get the, like you said, the xylophone, the tinkling, like there's, you realize like, oh, there's a language to coldness, you know, being depicted in like isolation and snow that genuinely has like a visceral effect on me. It cools me off. And it was
such a
profound thing to find out as a little kid, to be like, oh, the soundtrack, independent of the movie, does this thing to me, which shows the power of a soundtrack. And I think you said something that I think, you know, a lot of great and humble composers say, which is like, if you're paying attention to the soundtrack, like something's not working. But like, come on, people are paying attention to the soundtrack because it's gorgeous. You know, they're not, doesn't mean it's ruining the scene, just because underneath you have this deep appreciation of that. You're aware that you're being lifted and touched by the music as much as anything else that's happening. Right, guys?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's like if it's gone, you're really going to feel it. And there are times where it's supposed to just be there and you don't really notice it. But there are times where it should be a little bit more in the focus. And there's sort of that dance with the score where it sort of comes into the focus and then it goes back and sort of, you know, doing very functional things. And I think that dance is such an important part of it. And there's a lot of people, you know, responsible for that dance as well. It's the direction, the mixer. The mixer is a very important person when it comes to that. And a good mixer really will. I was talking to a friend of mine who's an excellent mixer, and he was talking about how he's now like really doesn't think about technical things so much anymore when he mixes. He really thinks about the, what's going on in the story and the narrative. And I think it's like, you know, it's kind of all the same thing in the acting, the composition, the mixing, you know what I mean? Everyone is sort of doing the same thing with a different medium. It's really interesting.
And I do, the mixer.
It's the collaboration. It's like when I didn't really get it until I started producing and I was shooting, starring a film with this actress and it was her first film, right? And we're shooting in Hawaii and it's her first film and she's acting. And I was like, listen, like, I don't want to tell you not to act, but I'm going to just explain to you, like, we don't have to act like we're in Hawaii because we're in Hawaii. And now look at the room. Look what the production designer did. Like, this room is dingy. It's messed up.
Don't have to push so hard. Yeah.
You're just like, look what the lighting guy's doing. You see how it's all orange and auburn cutting through, and it's just honest. And now look what the camera's moving slowly across the screen. Now imagine what the music guy is going to be, the composer's going to put.
Nice.
So you actually don't have to do anything.
Oh, all
you
got to do totally is like, look at me. Like a producer. That's great.
And then they're going to help us all with our performance, and our performance is going to help all their. It's like all these artists. That's the magic thing about movie making and television. For it to work, like 30 artists have to like somehow hit the right chord at the right time.
Yeah.
At the same
point. Yeah. And leave room for each other.
And leave room for each other.
Did she get it? Did that resonate? Did she respond
to it? Yeah,
I would love to. That's a great thing to kind of
You don't have to eat
into.
The scenery up. You just have to be present in this moment. There's times later for you to eat the scenery. Like this moment, like let the composers do their work as this really slow movement. This camera movement's going to creep into us. Like just imagine what they're going to do. They're going to do it. I believe it.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
I feel like I've seen so many shows that, I mean, there was a show I genuinely really liked, and I'm not going to name it, but I couldn't watch it because the mix was so, there was a constant music bed, and it was, and it's turned way up, and you get the feeling that somebody there at the network, someone somewhere is like, this isn't exciting enough unless it's constant music underneath. Mm-hmm. And to me, I always say, I don't want to ride the amusement park ride version of this thing. I want to see it and experience it. And that's how you feel. You feel like you're like, oh, this is the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland because it's meant to bombard you and it's sort of part of it. But like when it is cranking the whole time, it's too loud. It is like
it's
it feels
the worst.
Desperate. Like Dante's saying, it feels like the music is chewing the scene. Like, ha ha ha, isn't this great? Everyone feel a certain way. Ha ha ha. You know?
And you just imagine like someone being like the producer or director or someone being very out of touch with their audience. You know, it's like you don't have faith in the audience. You're sort of you have to tell them every moment to tell them what's going on. And it's like, no, people are much smarter than that. Like you don't have to do that. You know, I really am not a fan of the bed of music.
Do you have that too, Rishi, where you're like, you have that moment where you're like, there shouldn't be music here? Or conversely, do you guys both have the there should be music here moments when you're watching media?
I almost never feel like there should be music. And one of the funny things about my job sometimes as a composer, I think it is often to talk the director or the producers out of certain moments where they want me to do stuff. I'm like, I actually think you probably don't need music here. It's a strange thing, but I do think that that's part of the skill that you develop as a composer is knowing when those moments are necessary and when they're the most effective. And sometimes you just have to say like, actually this will play better without it. Cause then in the next scene, when this happens, it'll be subtle. It won't be subtle if it's already there before, you know.
Exactly. Very, very true.
There's nothing like the telling someone you don't let me do my job because I shouldn't be doing my job in this moment.
That kind of became a running joke with Cora in the spotting sessions because I was constantly pushing to have silent scenes.
Yeah.
And they were like just like,
Janet's
are you
voice,
just lazy?
It's just a musical instrument on its own. I'm sure that's what was being said.
Right, right. No, and it was all, you know. The nice thing is, like, I have such a close friendship with Mike and Brian that we could have this kind of heated collaborative debate and it was cool and like no one was going to get fired and I think that's what, you know, also helped make things better. But there were a lot of, well, I don't know, a lot. There were a handful of moments where, you know, people felt very strongly one way or another and we would debate things, you know. but a lot of it was, you know, there shouldn't be music here or bring it in, you know, much later. Like, because I always say, like, why is there music in this scene? If you can't answer that immediately, there probably shouldn't be music in the scene.
Whoa. good. Mm. Yeah.
That's pretty
that makes
good.
Sense.
Yeah.
But as a director, sometimes you're with great guys. Yeah. You're like, I have great music. Because I have a Ferrari. I'm going to drive that car.
Right.
Like, I have a Ferrari.
We're gonna totally, make, yeah, yeah. Jeremy's going to write music. He
don't drive
will, right. He's
probably got a Ferrari.
Oh, I had a question for Jeremy. I was wondering, in the first book, was there a moment or an episode early on where that feeling of, you know, kind of being daunted at the about the task that you were taking on, like, really felt most acutely? Like, was there an early episode or a cue
yeah.
where you're like, oh my gosh, I have to write this very long thing. How do I do this?
Yes. I think the first, okay, well, there's two things. One, actually, one, the first thing I thought of isn't very long. And it was the last scene at the end of the second episode, which would have been the first episode because they were shown back to back when they're flying away in the little Kalimba thing.
Yeah.
And that cue I was very stuck on because there's like a little twist that happens when he's like, let's go here to this place and this place. And he shows the map and when Aang's showing right. the map. And I just didn't know, for some reason, I didn't know how to make that shift, you know, into the mood shift. Like, I was really feeling the Kalimba thing and I wanted it to ride out. And like, and those kinds of like shifts were sort of new for me.
Well, the shift from what to what? What was the what were you
the Kalimba, like, nighttime sky? It's vibey and it's quiet, and they're floating away. And then suddenly he gets excited, and Aang is showing them like all these places he wants to go on a map, and all these things, these sort of fun activities they can do. And it's like a very sudden shift. And so that was like difficult for me to sort of navigate at the time, even though it's a very simple thing. You just change. You know what I mean? But like, I just couldn't like wrap my head around like suddenly changing without a transition or something. So that took way too long to figure out. And then the other thing was, I think the first like really long action scene, I hated doing action scenes at the time. Like, I just, they were so draining for me. You know what I mean? Like, and I felt like I was like, they were awful. Like, I felt like I sucked at doing them. So I was like, oh no, I have to do an action scene.
What did you pull from? Were you like percussion, strings? Like, what did you, when you saw action, like, what was your go-to feeling?
I guess that's probably part of it. Like, I was figuring out the palette, but yeah, it was like, you know, percussion, strings, brass. But a lot of this stuff I was really like learning. Like, I was studying orchestration books and scores like frantically, because I had been to music school, and I had like even went to graduated from graduate school. But
went
I didn't
to Cal
study
arts and yeah. Berkeley, right? Like, yeah,
right.
Jeremy's but I didn't like, study. I went to college. I know this stuff.
I mean, we wanted to tell the best story possible, you know. All of us. And Brian's references were insanely ambitious, you know, like things with duduk, like all these different non-Western instruments. And he'd play me things, Warsaw Village Band and these other things. And I mean, I've told stories about this, like how I had to go buy a duduk and learn it and play it for an episode in 2 weeks, you know.
right.
And I would never do. I was actually just talking to Brian yesterday about that. Like, I would never. I don't know if I would do that now. I don't think I would think it's possible. Like, I'm just old right. and tired.
You didn't know better, so.
Yeah, we were like young. Yeah, we believed anything was possible, and like we just made it work.
You should have a podcast called Song Exploiter. And it will be about how you got exploited to learn a new instrument. Anyway, as far as action scenes being hard, I would just add that I, as an actor, I always dreaded going in for ADR because it's really hard to scream and punch and make sounds, and you're worried that you don't sound right. And then you hear the animators. I feel like the South Korean animators were like, oh, the action sequences, they're so taxing and hard. So it's interesting that you would have that experience.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like collaboratively, you're picking up on the same thing that everyone is, which is like, oh, those are
they're brutal.
Tough. Those are tough, you know.
They're so
exhausting,
important,
you know.
And yeah, they're so important, and that's supposed to be like a real, you know, crowd pleasing moment. And so we all have to get it right. And of course, all the martial arts was real, right? It was all real martial arts that they were doing, so that there was tons of detail there.
Yeah,
and you can't like be the one who's not putting in the work when everyone else is.
You were talking about the sort of concern about Zuko's themes and like, but like not wanting to lean too hard into the sort of cliched expectation of what good guy or bad person music and you know, good person music and bad character music were like, and also the sort of use of certain instruments for things like suspense and action. Are you plagued by the, boy, I better reinvent this? Do you go into those corners temporarily where you're like, it's not worth doing if I'm not, you know, creating this totally new thing?
Yeah, I'm going to say yes and no. Absolutely, a lot of times, and I know that's the ego speaking when that's happening, right? Because like we want to be recognized and we want to stand out in the crowd and all that stuff. But also, if you really remind yourself that you're doing, you have to do what's right for the scene and the project, then hopefully that will take you out of that headspace, right? Which is why in some ways functional music like that is easier on the brain in some ways than writing your own music, which is like what Rishi was talking about, sort of the horror of trying to create your own work. That's terrifying, right? And like you're not, it's not, you know, you don't have a bunch of people or a project to sort of hide behind, but you're the person in front and center. And that's definitely when those thoughts really plague me more so than when I'm scoring, you know. But absolutely when I'm scoring, those thoughts are still there. And even down to like choosing the instrumentation in the very beginning stages and writing a theme, and I'm like, oh man, I've written this theme before, you know what I mean? And especially with like film music, there's only so many kind of themes and progressions you can write before it's just too strange, right? And it's not relatable, and it's not in the, like what you're talking about, it's not in the language that we sort of collectively have come up with over the course of how many years we've been telling stories, right? Centuries, generations. Yeah. So there's like a language there. And if you go too outside of it, like it doesn't work anymore. If you try to be too original, too interesting. So it's a very like tricky thing to navigate, actually. It really is.
Yeah.
I think it's so great to hear you guys talking about this and being transparent about it, not just here, but on other appearances that you've done. Because, you know, reminder, like if I'm at a signing, I can't tell you how many CD covers of the soundtrack I have signed. That is the thing that people bring in. It's just nice to hear that we are all still, artists are on whatever level they're on, you know, that they can be plagued with those insecurities, because it reminds us all to push forward in whatever our passion is, knowing that those voices are going to be there. It's inevitable, but part of the journey is acknowledging them and figuring out what your method is to kind of push past them. Right, Rishi?
Yeah, yeah. The last score that I did was for a video game that takes place in Alaska. It's like a dog sledding game. You're wow. a young woman who's trying to survive. The story is she basically joins the Iditarod. She has has like a little bit of an existential crisis, moves to Alaska to try and race the Iditarod, but she's incredibly unprepared.
I feel like I would love this game. I should play it on a hot summer day.
it's a really like soothing game, but it takes place in Alaska, and it is, you know, it's very sparse, and I had to think about these things that you were talking about, like the sound of coldness. How do I make it feel cold? And as you were saying, there are certain sounds that evoke coldness. And as much as I would want to be like, well, let me do something brand new that nobody's ever heard before, it's also like the language of that emotion, there are certain sonic textures that you have to bring in. And if you try and be too original about it, you'll miss the mark.
As composers, this is like what you do, right? So if in your own lives, your own love lives, you're going to kiss your partner, you're holding hands in the park, you're watching a sunset, you know, we've all done this. Are there music and themes coming into your mind for your own life? Because, I mean, as a filmmaker, I'll step out and be like, this is a real cinematic moment. I can almost see how I would shoot my own love scene as I'm walking through the park with my girl, right? At any moment, you're like at the beach seeing a beautiful sunset, and you're like, just start hearing music that's not there, but just in your mind?
Wow.
Or am I just tripping?
I think it's a fair question. Know.
That's a cool question. I think I hear music throughout the day, but I'm not super like hyper aware of it. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I definitely like sort of interpret the world in a musical way. Like, and I think I used to be much more aware of it like after grad school, right? Because grad school and you're like thinking about metaphors all day long and stuff. Sonic metaphors for like whatever experience I'm having or a visual thing or something like that, right? But at this point, I don't notice it so much anymore. And I'm wondering if I stopped doing that or if it's just like integrated into my like...
Super integrated, yeah.
Yeah, into my experience. I hope I didn't stop doing that.
Cut to Dante Bosco creates existential crisis for composer.
Yeah, exactly.
I hear all kinds of minor chords. I hear minor chords.
Thanks so much, Dante. Oh man, I gotta call my therapist.
Jeremy, I didn't want to let this episode go by without acknowledging that the podcast themes are thanks to you. We got our own little mini soundtrack of just kind of like getting the even get. I mean, that was so exciting to be like, anyway. Okay, well, we want it to be exciting. Aww. And we want it to be a little thrilling, but not too, you know, want it to be too grim because, like, we're going to laugh a lot. And you did. You came back mm-hmm. with some wonderful ideas and you let us sort of choose. And great. Then you, once we settled on one, you were like, okay, great, but let me just work with a little bit because I'm ashamed of how some of this sounds. And we were like, okay. And then you came back with a new version. I was like, I want to be able to say I can tell all the things that are different, but it sounded amazing.
Sounds exactly the same.
It already sounded amazing. I don't know if I can turn up amazing anymore, but I want you to be happy with it, and it sounds amazing.
That's very sweet of you to say. That's hilarious. Yeah, I think welcome to my brain. I think I sort of spent a lot of unnecessary energy getting that extra, you know, 3-4% that like no one really notices. I don't know. I think it's part of the process.
So the stuff that you sent over, Jeremy, the mm-hmm. like original kind of sampler, what was it that you sent? Was it stuff from the show or was it like cues that had been left over or did you make new stuff?
It was sort of a combination of the two. Like it was the main theme, but like abridged. And then I recorded some live brass for it.
Live brass.
And I mean,
you just whipped out a trumpet or something?
I know people.
You know people.
Yeah. But it's a very simple thing. And I mean, it sounds, you know, it's like from that very much from the Avatar world. And it's sort of a combination of things from Avatar reworked. But it very much, you know, it's the theme. It's the main theme. It's not the same thing as the beginning intro.
Right. That's what always made me so curious because I'm like, this is the music, but this is not the music.
Right. Exactly. Which is cool, right? Because it's like familiar. You know, that's it instantly, great. But it's new. Which is kind of the whole, right? That was the goal, I think.
As directors and producers, you hire artists in every department that think like that, do that, even though we don't know what they're doing. But we just rely on the fact that they're that good and they're crossing their T's and dotting their I's. I like what they're doing, but I think they're doing even more than what I know what I like.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about trust. Yeah.
Yeah. It's trust. It's
trust. Trust, right? I mean, that's the best. Like I've done stuff where I can tell the person I'm working with doesn't really trust me and it's miserable. And I've done stuff where I'm trusted and it's amazing, you know, and the product is always magnitudes better when there's the trust.
How about, have you had a situation, no names, but necessary, but have you had a situation where you have felt like you didn't have someone's trust, but you were able to turn that around and sort of realize like, oh, okay, like somehow we've crossed over into we crossed the threshold and now this person knows I know what I'm doing and like I'm doing it, you know?
No, that's interesting. You know, well, I guess I could say the very beginning of the process on Avatar. Just, and I get it. Like who were we? You know, we were these young punks who didn't know anything. Brian and Mike fought for us. They didn't tell us because they didn't want us to be stressed out about it. We found out years later.
That's a right decision on all counts. Fight for someone. Do not tell that person that you're fighting for them or it will crumple their heart.
Now in our Avatar verse and during this podcast, we always ask our guests a few different things dealing with the Avatarverse. One of them being a favorite hybrid animal.
I think the one I'm thinking of first is the turtle ducks.
Turtle ducks are a fan favorite. My favorite also. Yeah.
Maybe that's some low-hanging fruit. Is that low-hanging fruit?
No. It's important. No,
that's
it's
like
important.
Saying, I have the Beatles, they're not animals. So great because a lot of people like them. Like, it's okay that people love a thing that because it was a brilliant invention.
Yeah, and I'm going to go lower. I'm going to go even for even lower hanging fruit, which is the sky bison.
Of course.
Yes.
Look at my baby. I mean,
well, that is the best.
It's
everything.
Really. Yeah. And then with the baby sky bisons, come on.
I know.
In terms of the mix and the sound effects, Jeremy, and the voice acting, I was thinking about, I think for a long time, I didn't realize that Dee Bradley Baker did the voice of Appa. And I kind of thought it was more like sound design stuff. But I was watching episodes again this week in preparation for our conversation. And I was wondering, like, do you know, is that all his voice? Or is that a mix of his voice with special effects?
I know that Ben had done stuff with the lion turtles, which maybe is my favorite. Actually.
Oh, turtle ducks getting
you know,
ousted.
the big
kept
epic.
Kept the turtle, lost the duck. Yeah. I gotcha.
Of course.
Right. Sorry, Doug. I like them both for different reasons. But I know he had done something with that. But that was speech. Yeah.
I got to tell you, Rishi, just from Dante and my experience, right, Dee, I've been in ADR where that's where Dee does all of his sounds. And I have heard him, like, when I watch Naga, I do not hear any effects at all post-production. I hear exactly what I heard Dee do in the room. It is mind-blowing. Mm. It's mind-blowing.
He's amazing.
It's what is he doing? Is he doing all that? He does so much prep. He does so much prep. Yeah.
My mind is blown.
All right, what else you got, Bosco, before we let these guys go?
What kind of bender would you guys be in this world? Do you have an affinity to any of these things?
I always love the moment where I get to guess and wonder if I'm going to be right before the person says the answer.
Do you want to write them down so then you can prove that you're right?
I've never done that before. This is wildly intimidating. Okay.
Jeremy, you go.
You know, I mean, the obvious thing is airbender, right? Because music is moving air, pushing sound, right? But really, I don't know. I think it'd be pretty cool to manipulate fire.
Fire Nation. Jeremy, you. I knew that you and me were there.
I was wrong on both. Yeah. I assigned you neither of those. So I already am very
What did you assign me?
For some reason, I thought...
She assigned you earth and water.
I assigned you earth. I thought maybe you would kind of say... I thought you would get into the practicality of, like, the texture and the sort of, like, the solidness of it. It is the most kind of solid.
You gave me too much credit for depth of
thought. Jeremy, thank you for making it your fault.
Jeremy's about that heat,
that was a much deeper...
Jeremy's about that heat.
No, you know, in all fairness to you, I've changed my mind about 3 times.
Good. All right.
So I don't
I'm not. I do I not
know.
Mind admitting. That sounds great. I clearly have no idea what anyone's going to say at any given time, and that's okay. Yeah. All that being said,
it's reality.
Drum roll, please.
I think I would be an airbender.
Okay, I did say airbender for you. Then I got scared and thought maybe you would say water, and then that's why I said I wanted to give that person two, and then I said no, I'm backing off two. I'll only pick one, and it was air.
Air would be my first choice. I think water would be my backup
option. There you go. That's the order I put it in.
Yeah.
So I have a 50-50 record. That's not good. Nobody's going to get hired.
Not bad.
Nobody's going to get hired when they're wrong half the time. What are you going to do?
This is why I did terribly on the SATs. Anytime there's multiple choice, I'm like, well,
what? I could see a good reason for all of them. That is me. I absolutely
exactly.
do that. I'm like, well, if you look at it from a certain perspective.
Exactly.
And then there's one last question I want to ask you guys, because you guys are both aware and you've been through the whole show. So is there any relationships that you guys ship?
I feel like all of my fan desires were actually met by the show.
Nothing wrong with that.
Katang, then you're a big Katang person.
Yeah.
Exactly. I will, by the way, I also sometimes say to my wife, I say, Julie, do the thing. When I'm like asking her for a favor.
Excellent.
Julie.
Do the thing, Julie. Do the thing. It. John Michael Higgins, what a perfect man.
Yeah. I mean, that was the ship where I was like, is that going to finally, that was the biggest question mark. I felt like Kurosami was... That was, you know, that was in the cards, and I was excited for it to happen. Is that going to happen?
Yeah.
No, I'm so happy it did.
Was it discussed? It was obviously alluded to a lot.
Yeah.
I really didn't think that Nickelodeon or anyone's going to they were going to go there.
Jeremy and I talked about this a lot, actually, for his episode, because it is that, you know, incredibly significant final scene from Korra. It's that music that Jeremy discusses and breaks down.
You dug it. Right. So you dug Kurosami, Jeremy. I know from that episode.
I was so happy. I was freaking out. Yeah, Rishi, you did such a beautiful job on that episode of Song Exploder.
Your words and your music. So.
It's wonderful. It's so special.
You crafted something.
It's so, so special.
I will admit, I think about Aang's theme. I think about the... I think about that all the time too. It's probably crept its way into music that I've written in an embarrassing way. Now that I'm mentioning it, people will be like, people go back and listen.
You'll be hearing from my lawyers. <That's okay. laughs> No, that is so sweet.
Have you guys got to hear your music done by Hopeful Orchestra?
That's the dream. That is a dream of mine.
Yeah,
I want to do Sozin's Comet. Live orchestra, Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Oh, I like that. Let's make that happen.
I mean, we have.
Let's do it.
I bet we can make that happen somehow.
Podcast through ads.
I bet we can make a few phone calls and do that.
It would be fun to do it, especially to time it with some kind of astronomical event, like an eclipse.
Now you're
or
thinking.
Something like that.
Yes. Now you're going super big picture. I love it.
When's the next eclipse happening?
Into this.
So
comet or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we did for Malaga. There was a festival in Malaga in 2014, and they invited us. So we did two suites, one for Avatar and one for Korra, that were live orchestra and choir.
Amazing.
It was in this beautiful, like, old sort of broken down castle by the beach, like on the beach, and so it was all hollowed out. And it was, there was no roof, and it was just sort of the remains of the castle all around, and the stairs were still functional, and it was wild. It was so beautiful.
That's amazing.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you're saying it's already happened and we can't go. Okay, that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, there might be something in the future. There might
be. Okay, well, listen, we're all aboard, and it's sounding like that we already have four major power players who are devoted to showing Sozin's Comet live. You've heard it here. It's one of those podcasts where now that it's been said, Nicolini has to do it. So legally. I mean, I think they're legally obliged because we promised it. So
they're legally bound, yeah.
I'm really glad that you managed to fit in. You'll be hearing from my lawyers because that feels like a way I would love to end every podcast episode. I'm sorry we haven't been able to do it that way until this moment. Thank you.
The catchphrase.
Please tell
people
what else they should be aware of, what they should be, where they can hear certain new songs.
I am working on something for PBS. It's a beautiful documentary on the Rockies.
Uh-oh, sounds like my cup of tea already.
Yeah, it's beautifully shot. You know, I mean, there's something else I'm working on, a project of Mike DiMartino's that's
I have some. I'm immediately wildly speculating, and I'm excited about my own wild speculation. I have a good feeling about it.
It's going to be good stuff in the future. You know, Avatar Studios is up to some cool stuff.
Yes.
That's going to be exciting and beautiful. I've seen a couple things. Not going to say a word.
Great.
But it's inspired.
Don't get us
gorgeous.
In trouble, Jeremy. Don't get our podcast in trouble. Don't say one word, not more word.
Okay. Can I just say that the quality is even higher than you would expect?
Fabulous.
Wow.
So it's going to be good stuff.
Exciting.
Am I overselling?
No.
Never. Rishi.
I have a new song out. It is actually the first thing that I've put out that's a song of mine, you know, since before Song Exploder. It's called Between There and Here. It has Yo-Yo Ma on it playing cello, and it is, like so many things that I do, influenced by Jeremy's music, and I'm really excited for everybody to hear it. Plus, you can listen to the Song Exploder podcast, wherever you probably listen to this podcast. My website's rishikesh.co if you want to find me or read about any of the other stuff I do.
Beautiful.
I've heard the track. It's beautiful.
Between There Here.
Yeah, it's about my mom who passed away last year, and and Yo-Yo Ma plays the part of my mom in the song.
It's so beautiful. Without even thinking about the fact that we were going to be talking about soundtracks, I was like, I felt like I was inside like Oscar-winning film, but it was short and it was all audio. Congratulations on finding time with
Thanks
everything else we have going on.
One last thing to let you guys know: total solar eclipse, December 4th, 2021.
Oh snap! I can't believe I just said
total
snap.
Solar eclipse.
Visible
in North America, December 4th, 2021. Let's just throw that out there in the
That's
universe.
Quick.
We might be able to.
Yeah.
Just an idea. Just
let's get on it right just now. On the edge of doable.
Just on the edge of
doable. Next week, we'll be recapping a fan favorite episode, Jet. And yes, we will be having a conversation with Jet himself, Crawford Wilson. Do not miss it.
We'll see everybody next Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.